Welcome to Adelaide Plains Chapter and Verse monthly podcast for all aspiring wordsmiths and versifiers.
Okay, so here we are for another podcast. We're going to be talking about writers who write against type. So they're writing, we can talk about that further. I'm Carolyn Corden and we have with us...
I'm Michelle, hello.
I'm Marilyn, hello everyone.
And Jeanette.
Very good.
And it's possible we have some kookaburras in the background.
Well, that would be okay. I like kookaburras.
We'll pretend we're in a...
I don't get kookaburras where I live because I'm too far away from the water. There's a creek there, a river there, but it's not flowing at all. Okay, so...
Our news, yes.
Our news.
You had the PA?
Well, we had
workshop.
Workshop at the... Sharon that Kernow. Was excellent. Sharon Kernow did a workshop on the verse novel and she talked a little bit about her verse novel and I've just finished reading that verse novel and it's very, very impressive and that's a good model to put my verse novel on because she just gets it totally. And she gave us other verse novels to look into and other information. And when you've got people doing workshops, you know exactly what they're talking about because they can prove it because they've done it and they've done it very well. Well, that's, you know, that you've got a real person can teach you things. Verse novels.
And Sharon's got a verse novel published now.
The Art of Taxidermy. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's her
beautiful
only first novel. She's got her second book, long book.
And it's absolutely beautiful. So I bought it on the day I went to the workshop.
Yes.
Because I'm interested in doing a piece of writing myself on the long verse. And it was just really, she's just a really lovely presenter, very inspiring. But her book, I went home, I know it was a bit naughty. I went home and read it in an afternoon after she expressively told people not to do that. But it was really, it was exquisite. It was just utterly lyrical and it was really beautiful. So it was a great workshop. Mm. The Art of Taxidermy, an interesting concept.
Why didn't she want you to go home and read it?
Because people were going home and reading it in like 2 hours flat and she really wanted people to kind of
immerse themselves in it.
But I read it because you had to, like any really good narrative, you just really needed to know what happened at the end. But I would definitely go back.
It's
the
book that you can read
then,
a million times again and you'll pick up, there's so much in it. The characterisation is just exquisite. And you're seeing, with a verse novel, you don't do the background, this and that and the other, and it doesn't matter. You get the very essence of what's in a book. And if you're used to writing long fiction, it's quite inspiringly cut back and... Yeah. This was just perfect.
Well, the language is, there's a different way the language is written. So she, expressly said, now don't go home and read it in 2 hours. And then I promptly did. But I actually emailed it. I will read it again in more in depth because it was the story first and then the writing second.
But and you could just pick and choose reading the poems in there because the poems are so on point. Each one is just a piece of art in itself, each little poem. And they're not really lengthy poems. Oh, some of them are lengthier than others, but some of them are just very tiny little poems. And you can't see my hands, but I'm showing tiny hands. That's the art of... Not... Anyway, it's an exquisite little book. Big book, in fact.
Perhaps we should have a bit of a reading from it next time.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, that's a really nice idea because I've brought it and she'd be very happy if we did that. I think she's very generous.
The characterisations are perfect as well. Sharon is a person who knows what she's doing for sure.
So we'll skip over the literary news because I haven't done my homework and go straight to the poet or writer discussion and Marilyn can kick that off with her question.
We were going to talk about writers who write against type. I just wonder why do writers do this? Why does a male writer pretend to be a woman and vice versa?
Because women have better, more interesting stories than what men have.
We'll just edit that bit. I've got a story about a male protagonist because I felt that if I said what I was trying to write with a female, it would be viewed as about women.
Women's fiction, so men won't bother.
Oh, No. It would be viewed that I was making a comment about women, but if I made it a male character, it would be viewed as a universal. That really annoyed me that would be the case. I want either to be able to use either gender to make a universal statement, but I knew how it would be read as being, this is, you're saying something about women and work here, and no, I'm actually saying something about human beings and work. Mm. So I had to make it a male protagonist for that reason, which annoyed me. But in the end, that director, how I wrote the story and what happened, so it worked really well. I did make him a male that was surrounded by women, and that way it was more relatable. Someone for me to write about that I had to make him relatable. But he's not a nice character in the beginning. He's a very arrogant male in the beginning, but he learns. So that's one reason, I guess, but I don't think that's the normal reason. I think it's just someone wants to tell a story and you want a viewpoint that's different to your own. So it might be, you know, like I've got an example, Michelle Paver writing about the wolf. She wanted to have the wolf's viewpoint about what happens to the children. Okay. And just having different viewpoints, and that's just a viewpoint within the book.
Yes.
So it depends on your audience sometimes, I think. So if you want to appeal to a younger audience, you might write from a child's point of view, or if you want to appeal to particularly a male or a female situation, you might, you know, think that I'm fairly sure a lot of the romance novels are, tend to be written from the point of view of a woman, but not necessarily written just by women. So,
and of course, you've got people like in romantic, not historical fiction, Bronte, the Bronte sisters. The Bronte family, in fact. You got Anne Bronte, Charlotte Bronte, and the other Bronte.
Emily
Bronte, and their brother.
Whose name?
Bramwell.
They wrote
Jane Eyre.
Sorry, Jane Eyre.
Wuthering Heights. Agnes Grey, Tennant of Rufford Hall, Villette, Shirley.
And, lots.
And the
lots.
Professor.
Well, they wrote to be published without prejudice in male-dominated circles.
Yes, although most of the authors of the 19th century were women, the famous ones, which is
they were. I did a little bit of research and I found that a lot of the first
novels written by women
were actually females, and they were quite acknowledged as females.
Yes. And it was viewed as, you know, the novel was almost a female thing.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a skit in Blackadder where a male author is writing under a female name because he wouldn't get published otherwise.
Well, it has, the wheel has turned, has turned, and a lot of men are doing that now because they think they're more likely to get published if they're a female or known to be a female. And there was even one man who went to the effort of putting on a bra and taking it off again so that he knew what it was like. So
he could experience the discomfort that women are subject to.
Did he take the bra off while leaving his T-shirt on, though? You know, the famous through the sleeve? Because that is the sign of a true skilled woman, apparently.
I do think that I impress Graham when I do that. Okay, how did she... I don't know how she did that, but... It's always nice to impress your husband over something as minor as that one.
It might even be just your own personal desire to get into somebody else's shoes. I think that would be really interesting. Just that desire to kind of go, I wonder if I, because obviously you need to do a lot of research before you write anything. It'd be really good to sort of just really get into somebody else's
shoes. I think I enjoy writing male characters because I'm not putting anything of myself into them. They're totally outside of me.
Yeah.
Whereas I think there's more of a temptation with writing female characters. So I've really enjoyed, in one of the books I've written, I've got lots of different points of view to different narrators, which is probably too many and I'll probably need to cut it back. But I've actually enjoyed writing from a male point of view because the character, somehow I think I make my characters more interesting because they're so outside of me. They're so removed from myself. So, yes, I think sometimes writing someone else, you've really got to think. I've written, you know, some examples, but I think the funniest one I ever read was Julian Barnes, A History of the World in 10.5 Chapters. And you get through the first chapter and find out at the end that it's being written by the woodworm.
You don't know until the end.
No, but it's
funny.
Yeah. But I'm not sure it's quite how a woodworm would think. But
yeah. Who knows?
I was going to say, you could write what you want, can't you? The woodworm is not going to argue.
No, okay.
And no one's going to prove you wrong because no woodworm's going to sue you, that's for sure.
That's certainly the case, yes.
I was quite surprised to find out that Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Women and all the sequels, very feminine sort of a writer, I thought, wrote under the nom de plume of A.M. Barnard and wrote totally different kind of novels.
Yes, she did.
Yeah, and that wasn't, her little secret wasn't discovered until the 1940s. So.
I think that's an interesting thing too, because you wouldn't want to be, you know, like J.K. Rowling when she wrote her first not Harry Potter book.
Yes.
Wrote under a different name, and I think that may have been a male name, I'm not sure.
It was Robert Galbraith.
And
that's because she wanted to completely disassociate from herself.
She said she wanted to work without hype or expectation and to receive totally unvarnished feedback. That was the reason that she decided to write as Robert Galbraith.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she was, her publisher suggested that she use the initials JK rather than her name, because, I mean, we don't know whether she's Jennifer Joanna.
Joanna, yeah.
Is she really?
Yeah.
Second guess. There you go.
And no K, she doesn't have a second name.
Oh, she doesn't. Okay.
No, K just worked.
Yeah, works. It does work well.
Yeah.
Because that was... Yeah, K, that K initial was just there.
K Rowling, J Rowling. Her publisher thought that it would be better off if she was not known to be a woman because the younger boys would not want to read it.
Isn't that interesting? Because from a teacher's point of view, I don't really think that would have bothered most boys, because it's not like it turned them off the reading. And the Harry Potter books are equally, I don't see them as gender. But it's interesting, isn't
the boys'
it?
I'm not a publisher. Books. Yeah. Are written by women. Well, the Wolf Brother books by Michelle Paver, Cornelia Funk, they loved her writing.
Yeah.
So they don't... Yeah. A good book's a good book to most kids, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
And also I think we shouldn't encourage prejudice in kids, and that just encourages it.
Well, I don't know. Kids like books. Kids who like books, they don't care.
Yeah, I think so.
The kids who don't like books, you maybe have to do these tricks to keep them interested. Mm. Yeah. Don't know. Catch them. I got into fantasy via dragons. Name escapes. What the, Anne McCaffrey.
It's interesting the authors didn't have to change their names. So Anne McCaffrey, Ursula Le Guin, they were writing under female names.
And they were very, very good storytellers. And that's what hooked kids, readers, young readers. Yeah. And adults could read that and still find a great story.
Okay, we'll move on to the writer's tip. And I think the writer's tip was just, there are no actual rules. Do what works for you.
Yep.
So people get too anxious about the, you know, how to and technique. You just have to write.
Well, as Michelle was at the writer's lock-in this earlier today, and she knew she had so many good words to write, and she was just there writing them all down.
Karen, we have to go. I go, no, I've got 42 left.
42 words. But she did over 1,000 words, and I did bits and pieces of three different things that I'm currently working on. Mm. So I've got, you know, half a picture book written and now, and I've got some further thoughts for a possible, not sure whether it's a memoir or just things out of my mind.
I think as well you need to recognise that sometimes different pieces of writing require different strategies in which to write them. Like, I came across a tip where you just get, you know, the little cards that, like, when you're saying a speech and you hold your little cards, like
placards. I was very impressed with the way you were using those cards. I think she's playing poker here or something. I don't know, but just, she's going, she's writing. Just let it go.
She's
doing well.
What I do is on a placard, I'll put, like, say, chapter 1 or chapter 2 or chapter 3, and then underneath on separate placards, I might write one line of what I want to include. And so I'm working on two pieces at the moment for uni. So one is more fiction and one is a news article style writing. But then you can move the cards around. And I found that was a tip I got just off the internet when I was Googling different ideas. And it's been really helpful just to order thinking, but also to remember bits that I wanted to include, but to sort of go, actually, I'm just going to pick this bit up and put it over here, and it's fitting more. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like Carolyn said, I had all my bits set out, and I tend to be a writer who I'll be writing and then I'll have another thought and quickly scribble it next to me sort of thing. So, but, you know, that's working for that style, but other ways I've done different things. So, I think... don't lock yourself into any particular idea.
I'm totally disordered. I just write, and I think that's part of the problem, but anyway.
That's fine, and that's good to get the words down. You have to get the words down, otherwise you can't do anything with them.
No.
But editing afterwards is...
Well, I edit and edit. In fact, that's what I'm doing now. The trouble is that when I'm editing, I end up... Right now, it feels like I'm rewriting. I'm changing a lot. But this is a book I wrote 20-odd years ago.
Oh, there you go. Yep. So you've sort of changed.
And I think my writing has moved on so much in 20 years. It has. So, but because it's been boiling over in my head for so long, and I've thought a lot about it, I'm adding more in. I think I've got more detail to add to it.
Yeah, this subconsciously.
It's funny, sometimes I'll write something and then I'll look at the next paragraph and go, word for word. I'd already written it almost. And sometimes it is so close to something I wrote years ago. It's incredible. Okay. So you can see that those tracks are there in the mind. Okay, the word of the day. And this one was totally tied to our festival theme this year. It was myth history. Mythologized version of history, i.e. anything that comes out of Hollywood. But Shakespeare was the master at it. He did it as well. Macbeth is a prime example where you've got historical characters interacting with totally
fictional characters. You've got the royalty happening.
And fantastical characters, so Shakespeare is a classic example. Something I was reading the other day, Bortin mentioned that, you know, it's history turned into mythology, and it was a review of a film, I think. So it's very common. I thought it was a lovely word. It comes from the Latin mythos for myth and historia for history.
Of course.
It was first used by, or noted use was by Nathan Bailey in 1742. Myth history has been around a long time. Yeah. It's nothing new. So Shakespeare was the master of it.
I guess so.
And we will go to readings of own work.
I don't have any readings to do.
Actually, my first novel was a myth history.
You read yours.
For a tiny, tiny fragment from it, so. Strangely, our demise came through the loss of a family heirloom, our father's watch. A loss which not only caused a crisis in the fortunes of our family, but was considered to be the real trigger for the economic depression which swamped Australia. So that's your myth history. And the world in the 1930s. Just what the watch ever contributed to our family's fortunes is highly debatable. What is certain is that my father's belief in its efficacy to protect us was to lead us to the brink of destruction. The watch, a large 18th century hunter case repeater, was father's only valuable possession. It fell from his threadbare waistcoat on a thickly linked gold chain. The pearled face was protected by a 22-carat golden casing on which a hunting motif was moulded, embodying a culture which was as different to that in which father lived as it was possible to be. But despite its anachronistic condition, its golden chimes never failed to mark the passing hours with melodic persistence.
That's and from the gate. That watch, for sure. A watch of many possibilities, but reality was something.
Well, away from our, away from our desks at the moment, away from keyboards. I'll go to the listener's challenge, and I think maybe kookaburras, as we started out with kookaburras. And that's it. That's where we wrap up.
The kookaburra sits on the old gum tree, and there's the old gum tree over there. That's a river red by the looks of it. It's a biggie, that's for sure. And there's a river.
It is indeed. With water in it for a brief time, anyway. Goodbye, all.
Okay, see you later.
Bye.